This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070.
Local historian and cartographer, author Rick Britton joins us in studio every Friday. We try to make it every Friday to talk local history and whatnot. You were asking when we were coming out of that break, who is that? That little bumper. That's actually my daughter. I took the digital recorder home one afternoon, and we just sat in the den and let the kids do, you know, whatever you want to do. Uh-huh. And so I said, Skylar, you got to say something that gets people to pick up the phone and call
Skylar,
in.
Skylar, what a great name.
Yeah, well, thank you. And so she said, she just picked up the microphone and she said, you people better get on. And I was laughing so hard. I thought it was so funny. And then she just totally lost her train of thought and looked down and she said, do you like my new shoes? She's great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Can you believe this weather? I mean, in typical of Charlottesville, we went right from winter into summer. What happened to spring?
Yeah. It wasn't really much of a spring, was it?
Yeah, 80-some degrees. It's crazy.
Yeah. This was sort of like an upstate New York winter, where all of a sudden, winter's... There is no spring in upstate New York. All of a sudden, winter just, like, falls on the ground. It just gives out.
Just dies.
And then there's summer.
Gives up the ghost.
Yeah, like the next day, it's like 85 degrees.
Yeah. It's crazy.
So it is just beautiful outside.
And we had the
daffodils in the front yard, and it's great.
Yeah, we got flowers coming up too.
So what's going on with you? How's your book coming?
All kinds of great stuff. Well, I'm almost finished with the book. I had to put it off though because I'm putting together a presentation. I finished it today. You know, you had Frank Grizzard on yesterday.
Yes, with the Lee family.
Lee Family Digital Archive.
Yeah, he's down in Lexington. We had a really crappy phone connection.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to...
He was on a cell phone, yeah.
Yeah, which I told him, no cell phones, please. And I guess he just forgot, but it just sounded horrible. But you can hear him a little bit.
Well, with that, with the Lee Family Digital Archive, and he's already got some kind of presence up on the internet, Lee Family Digital Archive, he's hosting a series of talks. You know, this year marks the 200th anniversary of Lee's birth. At Stratford Hall, Westmoreland County, 1807.
Really? I didn't know.
And
that.
In order to honor, he was born January 19th, 1807, to honor the 200th anniversary and, of course, his project with the Lee Family Papers, he's hosting a series of talks, one every Sunday, at Lee Chapel at WNL there, you know, of course, where Robert E. Lee, after the war, was president.
Yeah, yeah.
It was Washington College at the time, and I'm the speaker. This Sunday at 4:00. So if any of the listeners want to come on down. I'll be talking about Robert E. Lee as an engineer on the Mississippi. You know, he's.
Let me just say before you talk about what you're going to talk about on Sunday. If nobody has ever been to the Lee Chapel.
Oh, my gosh.
Because Allison, of course, teaches at Washington Lee, and we lived there for a couple years.
Oh, my gosh.
It is beautiful.
It's fantastic.
I mean, it puts this little chapel UVA has to shame.
Oh, yeah.
It really does. I mean, it is really. And when you get up there and speak, you're actually very elevated.
Yeah.
I mean, people really look up. You're like a story above everyone.
Oh, yeah.
It is an absolutely beautiful facility.
What an honor for me to be speaking where the man is residing.
Yeah, that's where he's buried.
He's right there. Yeah.
And his horse, Traveler, of course, is buried just outside the door.
Yeah, it's right nearby. Yeah. Well, I was starting to say, though, it's gonna be great. And by the way, it's free and open to the public, so everybody can come and hear this talk.
And it's a very easy, very quick, easy drive. It's just an hour.
Yeah, it's not too bad. You know, he's most famous, of course, as the commander of the Army Northern Virginia, at the end of the war, commander of all of the Confederacy's forces in the field for 1 month. And he's famous for being the president of Washington College after the war. But nobody knows that the man spent 27 years in the Army Corps of Engineers, eventually made it to the grade of captain of engineers, and hardly anybody here in the East knows about his work at the harbor at St. Louis. Robert E. Lee is credited with saving the harbor at St. Louis on the Mississippi River.
You know, this is what you do on Fridays. You come in and you share
Isn't
this
that
stuff.
Fantastic?
You share this stuff that I have never, ever heard of.
Well, that's why you want to write about this, is to highlight this and bring these stories out.
So Robert E. Lee was an engineer.
Was an engineer for 27 years. The greater part of his professional life, he was an engineer. You know, he graduated in 1829, second in his class at West Point. The man had not incurred a single demerit all 4 years at West Point, which is well nigh impossible. You know, you got a demerit if your shoes weren't shined, if your uniform wasn't straight or pressed. So that was the province of the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers, in fact, ran West Point. At the time, it was the finest engineering school in the United States. And so if you graduated high enough in your class, you got a posting to the Corps of Engineers, which was what everybody aspired to in the Army, to be an engineer. That meant you were the best. And so Robert E. Lee became an engineer immediately upon a graduation. They breveted him a second lieutenant in the Army Corps of Engineers. And he had a couple of other postings that were pretty boring for him. But then he got this plum assignment where he was the constructing engineer. He was the supervisor out there on the Mississippi in this amazing project. In the early 1830s, a sandbar started growing up right at St. Louis, but more toward the Illinois side. You know, the river there is over a mile in width. It's a huge river, even at St. Louis.
I've never been there.
I've never been there
but
either.
But it was the edge of the frontier then,
It was still the edge of the frontier. And the traffic, the commercial traffic with the steamboats was just starting to grow up. This is what's considered the upper Mississippi, from the mouth of the Ohio into the Mississippi all the way up, you know, another 1,000 miles. That's considered the upper Mississippi.
Okay.
And the traffic was just growing there. But this sandbar, because it was growing up right across from St. Louis, part of the current was being diverted to the Illinois side of this sandbar. And we're not talking about a little sandbar. This thing was called Bloody Island because of the number of duels that were fought over there on this island, because it was outside of the jurisdiction of either side, Illinois or Missouri.
You get on a boat and go across to the island.
Exactly.
And kill somebody.
You're not going to run into the sheriff out there. He's out of his jurisdiction. This thing was a mile in length, 500 yards wide, and had all these cottonwoods growing up on it. So this was this huge thing in the middle of the Mississippi River. When the current started diverting part of its force on the Illinois side, it threatened to cut off St. Louis entirely. Any major flood, and of course Mississippi has had its big floods over the years, any major flood, the entire main channel might have been diverted from the Illinois side. If that happened, St. Louis would have been a mile from its livelihood. It would have been landlocked for a mile away from the Mississippi River, and that would have ended, you know, the growth of St. Louis. And in 1830, St. Louis numbered already 14,000 people, and the commerce, the river commerce, all of the goods being transported, furs and all the other things being transported on the Mississippi, that was its livelihood.
And there was no West St. Louis at the time in Illinois who said, yeah, bring
you
it over
East
here.
St. Louis.
East St. Louis.
East St. Louis, right.
Yeah, that,
right.
That was saying, you know, hey, just...
No, not yet. No, not yet. Not yet. And so this would have been a huge blow to St. Louis and to the state of
Missouri. So this was Robert E. Lee's, Rick Britton is our guest. So this was Robert E. Lee's job to figure out how to fix this.
How to
fix the river.
Right, right. And the plan involved putting up a couple of dams. And when we say dams, we're talking about huge things. The one from the head of Bloody Island to the Illinois shore was over 600 yards in length. And, you know, about 40 feet wide. So this was a huge thing.
How did they possibly do this in the 1830s when they didn't have the cranes and the helicopters
to drop? Well, actually, they did have cranes, and they had steam-driven pile drivers mounted on boats. I mean, they, you know, so they had some machinery.
Okay. Yeah, they did.
But what they did was they put in a double row of pilings about 25, 30 feet apart. All right, now the river is flowing through those still. Then they start filling that in with stones and sand. Then they pile brush on either side, weight that down with stone, and by slowing down the water as it's coming through, the water starts dropping more sand, more silt. Eventually, it builds up and seals off the water entirely. So what happened was he was successful. He built up this dam, supervised the construction of this dam, built it up, and eventually, Bloody Island, this thing a mile long, 500 yards wide, got attached to Illinois and became east. It became part of East. East St. Louis.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. So today, that's a part of the city, part of East St. Louis in the state of Illinois.
Historian and cartographer Rick Britton joins us every Friday to talk history. And this is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Robert E. Lee. What is the E for?
Robert Edward Lee. Right.
Now, what is this? And then we want to get to the notes. But what is this book first?
Oh, I just wanted to mention that a new book on the Battle of Bastogne. It's entitled Alamo in the Ardennes. It's by a professor of history, military science, out at the University of Missouri. He's a great guy, John C. McManus. It just came out. It's published by Wiley. Up in New York, just came out, and it's got a big collection of six of my maps on the Battle of the Bulge. So check that out if you'd like to see some of my work.
What is the series, about World War II that follows, based on the book by Stephen Ambrose? You know, the
Brothers in Arms?
Is that what it is?
No, it's the
HBO series?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's Brothers in Arms.
Is that what it is?
I think that is.
Boy,
yeah.
That's great. I've seen that like five times.
That was fantastic.
That is terrific.
Yeah, and that involves the Battle of Bastogne.
Yeah,
and that's the 101st Airborne.
Yeah, and that's the first thing I think of is it was those guys there in the forest. And,
oh, yeah.
I mean, unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, that's
story.
Really, really well done and very accurate.
Yeah.
I understand, although my specialty is not World War II.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you drew these maps, so you had to do a hell of a lot of research.
I did. And they
to
sent,
pull
they,
these
they
maps
sent,
off.
Yeah, and they sent me maps that had been done by the Army, and so they were very accurate. And so my maps are based on those, on Army maps.
Yeah. And
illustrated at the time.
The name of the book, then, your latest maps are in?
Is Alamo in the Ardennes by John C. McManus. He's a great guy.
Rick Britton is our guest, and we had on the slate today to talk about
the
only book that not many people know this.
No.
It's not the only.
It is the only.
It is the only.
No, you're right.
But so many people think, oh, gosh, you know, Thomas Jefferson, he did everything. He was an inventor. Well, to my knowledge, he didn't invent anything. He refined some things that had already been invented.
Actually, he did invent possibly two things.
Okay.
One was a plow. He called it the moldboard plow of least resistance.
But he didn't invent that plow.
He tinkered with it. Mathematically, he perfected the moldboard, and the moldboard is the part that turns over, the wooden part that turns over the soil.
Right.
And he mathematically perfected it so that it would turn over the soil exactly once, which is what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
I say he invented it because he could have patented it, but Jefferson was against patenting inventions because it meant that the product itself would take longer in getting out into the public use.
Interesting.
So he was against, even though as Secretary of State under Washington, he was in charge of the founding of the Patent Office. He was against personally, you know, just in personal preference.
So many people assume, Rick, that Jefferson, you know, wrote the Declaration of Independence, that he must have been this great prolific writer. Now, he had left over 20,000 letters.
He did.
But he actually only wrote one book.
One book, right. And it's called Notes on the State of Virginia. You know, it's funny that thinking about this, I only realized recently that it's a double entendre. It's notes on the state of Virginia, but notes on the state of Virginia, because it's based on a couple of dozen questions that the French ambassador to the United States at the time sent him regarding all different aspects of life and the geography and the history of Virginia. So an example of one of the questions would be, you know, what about the mountains in Virginia? What about the rivers? Tell
what
me about the rivers.
The natives.
What about
the animals?
The aborigines. Right.
Right
what
right.
about slavery in the state of Virginia? What about the animals?
Yeah.
And so each one of these questions became the basis of one chapter in the book. And it's a fantastic book. In fact, a lot of people have claimed that it's the finest scientific book put together by an American prior to 1800.
Wow.
Now, he worked on this just as his governorship was ending. So he began work on Notes on the State of Virginia in 1781.
Which was another one of those periods where he sort of withdrew from politics.
Yeah, he withdrew from politics.
Because it was a horrible governorship.
It was the very nadir of his political career.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, a lot of people doubted if Jefferson would ever come back.
Because he just bombed as governor.
He was,
and he was a wartime governor during the Revolution.
And that's the main reason he bombed, is because Jefferson knew very little, next to nothing, about war and military matters. And all of a sudden in 1781, in the second year, and in those days there was not the restriction, so he could have been governor another year, but in the second year of his governorship, all of a sudden the British Army was in force in the state of Virginia for the first time, 7,000 men under Cornwallis and Bloody Tarleton, and Jefferson just ran around like a chicken with his head cut off, didn't know what to do. The proof is in the pudding.
And
I love
it was
to
a
tell
weak,
people.
It's a weak governorship at the time,
was
so there wasn't much. He couldn't wave his hand and like make things happen.
No, but a lot of people say, and I think this is justified, a lot of people say that he could have been better prepared, and the state of Virginia under his leadership could have been better prepared for a British invasion. It just hadn't happened yet, and so, you know, it hasn't happened, so it's not going to happen.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, out of sight, out of mind. All of a sudden, they were here.
We had a caller correct us. It's not Brothers in Arms. It was, of course, Band of Brothers.
Band of Brothers. Thanks.
Which is a,
thanks so
if,
much.
If you haven't seen it and you're interested in World War II at all, it really is one of the best.
Fantastic.
Dramatizations of
that and Saving Private Ryan, I think, are the best put together on World War II.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Jefferson puts together this book, and there's some really fascinating parts in it. One is his point of view on African-Americans. Jefferson, you know, it's kind of a touchy subject, but Jefferson did not believe that African Americans, that blacks and white Americans could coincide In the same country.
Yeah. And or later, live under the same government.
Live under the same government. Yeah. Yeah. So he was a big proponent of recolonization, colonization back to Africa. And one thing that interests me about that, I hope to write about, is that Abraham Lincoln, little known fact, Abraham Lincoln read just about everything that Jefferson wrote and adopted, you know, almost wholeheartedly most of his views. And so Lincoln agreed with Jefferson and had a plan to recolonize the slaves.
Some of the most damning writing against Jefferson is actually from that chapter about African Americans in Notes on the State of Virginia, where he just says, you know, these are people without art and without
you don't even want to quote some of the stuff.
Yeah, it's
and
just
people reading that would have to say that Jefferson was a racist, but you have to be careful of presentism. And presentism is when we look back with our modern sensibilities, our modern knowledge, our modern understanding, and judge somebody in the past. But Jefferson, in his own times, of course, was very liberal and very advanced. But by today's standards, you'd have to say that he was
but
racist.
But we should point out he wasn't the most liberal and the most advanced.
No, no, there hardly.
Were, I mean, Washington freed his slaves. And
right,
people,
all of them.
Yeah, the people in the 18-teens.
And Jefferson, and only seven.
They were, they were freeing their slaves left and right, even in Virginia at that time.
Right.
And Jefferson was not.
Absolutely, absolutely. Including one of Jefferson's friends, Edward Coles, who became governor of Illinois, second or third governor of Illinois in the 1820s, based on his anti-slavery stance. Edward Coles was from right here in Albemarle County. That's a story for another time. But one of the most fascinating parts about Notes on the State of Virginia is his writing about the digging up, the excavation of the Native American burial mound, the Monacan burial mound, which at the time was still prominent, at Manasuccapanal, right here in Albemarle County. It's only about 5 miles to the northwest of us here, right along Route 29.
Yep.
And based on his excavation of that burial mound, which at the time was like 40 feet around and 12 feet high, Jefferson is considered the father of modern archaeology.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. And that happened right here in Albemarle County in 1781.
That
excavation.
It was really, and he just cut a trench right through the thing.
Yeah, and it's not just him doing it, is the fact that he recorded it, the fact that he thought about it scientifically and wrote down step by step how he did it, then how he analyzed the remains that he found there, you know, all the bones. He estimated the bones of about 1,000 Native Americans. And what he guessed from that. So he invented archaeology, modern archaeology at that moment, and the modern science of stratigraphy, the study of different layers of soil.
Historian and cartographer Rick Britton joins us every Friday to talk local history.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.